From Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Throughout the year, we have had a lot of thoughtful conversations on Insight that defy a traditional space for news. We get to go deeper and take the time to explore issues that are far from simple and are hard to easily define. As we say goodbye to 2023, we're going to close with two great examples. This year, we launched two podcasts that encapsulate what we value here at Cap Radio. And we're going to start with Mid-Pacific, which explores what it means to be Asian American and the feeling of being caught between two worlds. As host Sarah Mises-Tan explains, through food, politics, mental health, music, and so much more, we learn how loaded of a question it can be.
After we kind of lay the groundwork for this term Asian American, I wanted to just like dive into some history, show people that there are deep roots of Asian American and Asian America in this country. And then we kind of just like stem out into topics that I have had conversations about with my own friends and family that tend to be common connectors for the Asian American community. So talking about like food, even though you may not speak a language or you may not be from that country, food can be a powerful connector. Talking about mental health, talking about representation in politics.
Today, we're going to revisit a conversation we had about family. Whether Asian American or you have a story of immigration or you are a 10th generation Californian, the family that comes before us shapes how we walk through life. And in recent years, the dynamic of Asian American families is taking more of the spotlight in pop culture. The biggest example being the Oscar-winning film Everything Everywhere All at Once, which hones in on the mother-daughter relationship, among other themes. And this film resonates deeply with some of the journalists you listen to on Cap Radio. Back in May, I sat down with Mid-Pacific host Sarah Mises-Tan, as well as Cap Radio reporters Janelle Salonga and Kristen Lamb. Well, Sarah, I want to start with you because as a journalist, you really took this personal shift with this series. You were exploring Asian American identity, but listeners also got to learn a great deal from many voices you included. And you really show that by interviewing your mom and your sister. So how did all of this come about?
Oh, my gosh. Well, the mother-daughter relationship has definitely been a topic that I've wanted to dive into for a long time. I feel like it's so complex, especially kind of with Asian American identity layered on top and this like acculturation gap that kind of happens when you've got a difference in immigration pattern and experiences in this country. And, you know, I think my relationship with my mother and my sister's relationship with my mother has always been kind of this like own narrative of its own, honestly. And so when I wanted to talk about the mother-daughter relationship, I initially actually was not going to include them because it seemed a little too close. But it was a story editor that we had who was like, well, why don't you just ask your mom what she thinks? And I was like, oh my God. But also, I hope people enjoy us getting real, real and a little bit raw, I guess.
Yeah. And I think it resonates with a lot of people. And so the springboard for the conversation that we're going to be having right now is the film Everything, Everywhere, All at Once. For those who haven't seen the movie, why is this a really profound symbol of Asian American identity and culture?
Yeah, you know, I guess I think of Everything Everywhere All at Once as being like particular in itself, just because it really gets messy when it comes to Asian American identity. I think as we're going to get into, there are a lot of lines that just like hit in a particular way if you are Asian American. And it just goes there with the mother-daughter relationship. It doesn't hold back. To me, it felt like a very real depiction of a lot of the conversations I've had with my own mother. And then I think like just the fact that it showcases different generations. I think that intergenerational conversations and intergenerational relationships are very much a part of the Asian American experience as well. And I think it just did that in a really nuanced way where it wasn't like stereotypical. And I loved that. And I think that's probably what resonated with a lot of people with this movie.
Yeah, I mean, it was very much real. But then there's also these kind of ridiculous parts as well. You're like, you know, because and I don't want to give it away, but it's definitely worth watching. So, Janelle, that brings me to you. How did this film resonate with you and your family?
Yeah, I mean, everything Sarah said is so true, I guess, for me as well, especially like watching those intergenerational relationships and this kind of like very fraught relationship with a mother and her daughter that kind of just stems from, you know, like different understandings of the world and of each other and different expectations along those lines. And I think that's something that, you know, is very resonant for me. But from, I guess, like a more lighthearted angle, as you were saying, like there are these moments like, you know, characters will say the name of, for example, like a movie, just a hair off what the actual movie title is. And that to me feels like such a relevant experience, you know, especially like having parents who immigrated, who, you know, sometimes like don't always have the right words in English, like right off the bat. Like that was very resonant for me. And then also there's like a line about, you know, the mom talks about how, you know, I hate that you get tattoos. You know that I hate when you get tattoos. I don't care if you say that it's for your family. I have like over 20 tattoos. And this is, you know, a conversation that I've continually had with my parents. So those are a couple of ways that, you know, for me, the movie, even in its lighthearted moments, made me feel really seen. Mm.
How about you, Kristen? Because you actually watched it with your mom, right?
Yeah, I mean, my mom also loved the movie, and particularly, like, one of her favorite things is just having a middle-aged Asian woman be the star and have so much range. And I think in general, like has been said, like, I just see a lot of my family and myself in the film. Like particularly, even though I'm like fourth and second generation Asian American with my family, like I still see like my grandparents on my dad's side immigrated from Hong Kong, speak Cantonese. Like the grandpa in the movie really reminds me of my late grandfather. And it's pretty wild.
So Kristen, what were some of the, like the hardest or some of the more emotional parts during the movie for you?
I think the ending sequence always gets me. Like the first few times I would watch it, I would always be like sobbing the last like 10 minutes. But I think like the confrontations, especially between like Evelyn and her father and then Evelyn and Joy, are always really hard to watch. Yeah.
How about you, Janelle?
Yeah, honestly, it's the same. I mean, I love the like just seeing the switch that flips with, you know, Evelyn talking about like her daughter's kind of like nihilism and depression and detachment as something separate from her to accepting like that is something that is part of her. I think especially as somebody who, you know, has mental illness, who struggles with their own things, like it's like really meaningful, I guess, to see that depiction of someone coming to terms with, you know, from the other side, that that's not like those, like the mental illness or, you know, whatnot is inextricable from how like that person experiences the world. It's not something that, you know, can kind of just be divorced from somebody's personhood. And then, you know, at the end, the confrontation where Evelyn says, "I am your mother, don't call me Evelyn." That's so like, you know, I'm in my 20s and that's still something, you know, I've joked around like, oh, calling my parents by their first names, but it feels so wrong. Like the "I am your mother" part is so funny. But it's also so emotional because that's like, I think, such a signifier of family relationships. And the speech that Kristen is talking about between Evelyn and her father, or Joy's grandpa, you know, is also has me bawling, you know, because that's also a signifier of Joy coming, or Evelyn coming to terms with the fact that her daughter is not this like perfect person, that she is a person who has, you know, dreams and goals and feelings all on her own. And no matter how much like she as a mom wants to control that, you know, she can't. And that is really emotional for me every time.
Yeah, regardless of her family, we're still constantly learning about each other. And a big piece of that is acceptance, right? And accepting our family members. How about you, Sarah?
Oh, totally. I think I'm going to jump on and agree with Kristen and Danielle that last scene where Evelyn confronts her daughter. Oh my God. I like cry every time I watch it. It's like actually visually difficult for me to get through it without having to turn away. I was like looking too close to the sink. Getting too close to the sun, honestly.
Watching with your like finger with your hands in front of your face.
Totally. I mean, I'm tearing up just like talking about it a little bit, just because it's like, you know, for me, I felt like it was like this moment that was, I have I guess maybe like many Asian American daughters, I have a somewhat difficult relationship with my mother, and my career choice is not something that she saw for me. And so I really resonated a lot with Joy as just like being this example, almost like a villain to my mom's life, which I think is something that really resonated with me. Like my mom, I think sometimes looks at me and is like, you are the literal foil. Like you are just here to torture me. And so it's like a really, I guess it's a moment of relief when Evelyn and Joy have that confrontation, and Evelyn actually like, she says she's sorry, and that's something that I think a lot of maybe immigrant mothers have a difficult time with sometimes. And I guess that's like, I don't know, I guess they just say things that I wish my own mother could kind of like be able to step back yeah. and see in herself and maybe say she's sorry. I guess I wish that we had that moment ourselves, and we just, we don't, because this is real life and not like a superhero movie.
Yeah, what I've learned just being mixed race, and it's not only with my Asian American background, but, you know, oftentimes like people in my family show they're sorry. They don't actually yes, say totally. They're sorry,
so,
right?
Yeah, absolutely. So,
that word is a tricky one. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking with Cap Radio reporters Sarah Mises-Tan, Janelle Salonga, and Kristen Lam about how the movie Everything, Everywhere, All at Once resonated with their Asian American identities. So this movie touches upon a lot of themes. I mean, the daughter, Joy, is an only child. But for what I'm going to ask you next, this is also be considered like the eldest, right, of the family. How did this resonate with each of you, Sarah?
Well, I am, I guess, the eldest, eldest daughter. And so there are a lot of expectations, I think, and this is something we touch on in the podcast as well. But for some reason, I think eldest child, especially for a family that has immigrated to this country, I think there's a lot of expectations on what that child's going to be and what their career is going to be and who they're going to, you know, all this kind of stuff. And so I feel like all of that layered on top of, I think, just general expectations that mothers have for their daughters, because oftentimes I think mothers see daughters as an extension of themselves, and it gets really intense for Asian Americans in particular. You know, I think when it comes to, I guess I like don't want to stereotype or like speak too much for other people, so I'll let Janelle and Kristen jump in a second. But, you know, when it comes to like the very particular kind of back and forth poll that we discuss about being a first daughter and being Asian American, I think it's basically like the most it's a very intense push and pull of like you trying to define your own identity versus someone else kind of putting expectations on you and you feeling pressure to fulfill those expectations.
Yeah. Conditions, right? Yeah. How about you, Janelle?
Yeah, and I think, too, I'm also the eldest, but it's kind of an unusual dynamic in that my sister is, you know, almost 12 years younger than me. So in a sense, I spent most of my early part of my life as an only child. And I do think that, you know, that experience was very starkly different, you know, from my teenage years for a lot of different reasons. And I think, you know, the fact that my mom had me when she was, you know, comparatively young, you know, she was still in her 20s, whereas, you know, my sister was born when my mom had lived a little more life, right? Like, I think that that is like another layer of the dynamic of, you know, just it's essentially, you know, my mom is growing up kind of at the same time as I am. And I think that that makes for a lot of misunderstandings and a lot of expectations in different directions, especially with kind of like, you know, the cultural background of different expectations. You know, my mom is from the Philippines. I was born in America. And I think that there are some, I guess, like there's some chafing there between what's expected and what's maybe I'm just kind of like sounding like a broken record repeating what Sarah said. But yeah, I think there's this concept that is often referenced that I feel a little bit loath to reference because I think it's a little more complicated than people usually depict it. But it's called utang na loob. And it's kind of this idea that you're, you know, in debt to your family. But you know, with a little bit more weight to that, not in the sense of like, oh, this is a terrible burden I must bear, but like the burden of gratitude almost. And so, you know, navigating that, I think, especially as somebody who has complicated feelings about being American is definitely, you know, something else to be added onto the pile of, you know, what makes like being the eldest, specifically in an Asian American family, like very fraught, I guess.
Yeah, there's another layer to this because the daughter in the film is openly gay. So how do you feel this dynamic? How do you feel it was portrayed in the film? Kristen, I'll start with you.
Yeah, I mean, I am a gay woman, and I have also had times in my family where kind of processing that has been difficult. Like some of the lines where Evelyn says that she thinks that the grandfather would have a heart attack, wouldn't be able to handle, like knowing that his granddaughter is gay, or even when she tells Joy, you know, he's from a different generation. Like those are all exact things my mom has told to me about her own mother. And I feel like it was really, it felt really real. And yeah, it can just be like, I see like how I can see like my mom's like how she has kind of grown and our relationship has also changed. I mean, you know, the grandfather's still alive in the movie, but in my case, like some of the issues that I had with grandparents, with like, you know, this is just my partner, it's just my friend, you know, now those, some of those grandparents are no longer with us. So I felt it was very real and very personal.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that. Janelle, what did you think about, you know, the choice that they made by including this dynamic in the film?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's so, I'm so glad that they included it, because I think that, you know, especially seeing, I don't know that Joy, you know, necessarily comes out and says, like, I'm a lesbian necessarily, but I think that, like, having, you know, specifically, like, gay women in like movies or TV shows isn't necessarily something that is still super common. And I feel like that is huge. And especially to do that, you know, from the lens of the Asian American experience is also pretty impactful, because, you know, just as like being a person is impacted by, you know, your cultural background, like obviously how you experience, you know, dating and sexuality is also influenced by that cultural background. And I think like, you know, I've also had a lot of friends who have dealt with those kind of same dynamics with their parents, and that kind of tension of, like Kristen mentioned, that idea of like, oh, your partner is just your friend. And it, I think it was really meaningful to see all of that like represented like at large in a way that like, you know, didn't really diminish like Joy's sexuality, or didn't say like, oh, this is just some random thing. And I really appreciated that there was, like, you know, nuance to that.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious, you know, like, when you watch the trailer, you were obviously, like, all in on watching the movie. Did it meet your expectations? Sarah?
Oh, my gosh. Yes. I think, I mean, you know, I love that it's kind of like a superhero, like a weird, fantastical superhero battle for so much of it. And then it just like hits you right in the emotional gut at the end. I think I wasn't really expecting that. I was expecting it to kind of be more lighthearted and funny. And it is. But yeah, I think it delivered personally.
How about you, Janelle?
Yeah. I mean, I had no idea what to expect going into it. The reason that I watched it or wanted to watch it was actually because of this Twitter thread that my friend made, you know, speaking about how the movie raised questions of what would it be like, you know, if we let go of our debts to each other, if we let kind of the like misunderstandings just be and make an effort to better accept and understand each other where they are. And so that was my understanding of the movie going into it. I didn't expect to, you know, have so much fun watching it, but I also did not expect to like bawl my eyes out. It was kind of gross. Like I was in the theater and like there's tears collecting behind my mask and I was like, this is terrible. But in that way, it totally met expectation, or like I guess like exceeded expectations, and I really loved it. I've watched it way too many times than probably I should, but yeah, I loved it. I love that it was like, I think, a really good piece of science fiction. You know, speaking about like the apology, this like fantastical apology, it's science fiction in the sense of like it's improbable, but it's not necessarily impossible. It's something that we can imagine in our own lives. And I thought that was really, I thought that was really magical to be a part of.
Yeah, I love that. I mean, it dives into like really like heavy dynamics, but it's also so much fun, right? You know, they have a lot of fun with it. Kristen, what was your favorite part in the film?
I really like the rock scene. yeah, there are just some parts where it's just like so wild and you're like, oh my gosh. And I also like the parts that make my mom uncomfortable, like some thing scenes with trophies that they sit on. those are good.
Oh my god, I love that there's like a scene where they're like the two Evelyn and Joy are fighting, and at some point Evelyn's just like, Joy, why are you wearing such a stupid outfit? And I was like, oh my god, it's like exactly something my mom would say in the middle of like an actual like serious discussion, just something like totally irrelevant, like, oh, we're gonna worry about what I'm wearing right now. Okay.
Like, are you listening to me? Yeah. How about you, Janelle?
I know we've been talking about mother-daughter relationships, but I really love the dad. I think my, you know, typically Asian dads are presented as stoic, but my dad has always been really silly and funny, and I think Waymond really got to the heart of that, and I really loved, you know, his philosophy about, you know, choosing to see the good side of things. I think that was really powerful, and I cried at that too, but I cried at a lot of the movie, so.
Well, I want to thank all three of you. What a fun conversation.
Thanks so much, Vicky.
Yeah, thanks.
That is my conversation with Mid-Pacific host Sarah Mises-Tan, along with CAP Radio reporters Janelle Salonga and Kristen Lam, sharing how the movie Everything Everywhere All at Once resonated with their Asian American identity. Our conversation first aired back in May, and you can listen to the podcast Mid-Pacific at capradio.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Up next, we'll get a taste of CAP Radio's newest podcast, This Is What It Feels Like, in an episode that was a fan favorite, a 106-year-old who defied the stereotypes of getting older. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicky Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
You're listening to a special edition of Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We are closing our final show of the year, taking a listen back to the new podcast that CAP Radio launched in 2023. And that brings us to This Is What It Feels Like. It has a simple, open-ended premise. In a world that feels more divided than ever, put yourself in the shoes of everyday people that are often overlooked or politicized by society. The life experiences were wide-ranging and all first-person narratives. Host Tara Lopez explains how the idea for a podcast grew out of her art exhibit.
The whole idea behind the original exhibit and this podcast now is simply to ask all of us to treat one another better. I believe if we can truly hear and see someone for who they are rather than for what they are or what they've done, I think that's when compassion and empathy can build and we can see a situation from that person's perspective rather than from our initial judgments. That's where things can change, and I think it can be really powerful.
The first season just wrapped this fall, and while all of the episodes were powerful, there was a fan favorite, and it features a 106-year-old woman named Glenna, who dismantles and gives us a deeper understanding about getting older, along with her granddaughters Cassie and Sarah by her side. As Tara Lopez puts it, instead of focusing on what we lose as we age, Glenna's focus is living simply and staying inspired to the very last moment. So here's the episode.
What was the best day of my life? The day I was born, honey.
My entire life, I have felt like I've been searching for something. I remember even as a young kid questioning what my life purpose was. And the days that I struggle with my mental health, I still do. Like most of us, if not all of us, I often wonder what the meaning of life is. What does any of this mean? The good, the bad, the in-between moments. Life lately can feel a bit monotonous, a especially over the last few years, where time has felt suspended but also fleeting. And as I've gotten older, I've found that it's really easy to isolate. I can go for days at a time without truly connecting with someone before I even realize it. It was during one of those bouts of isolation when I met Glenna. Glenna is a 106-year-old woman who lives in Rio Linda, California. She's a friend's grandmother. And over the years, I had heard small stories about Glenna, how she plays her piano nearly every day, and how she likes to watch The Bachelor every Monday night.
What do you think about The Bachelor and Bachelorette?
What do I think about it? Well, I think they're pretty silly. You know, all they do is kiss. Just kiss, kiss, kiss. From one to the other, it's a wonder they don't catch something. I was the bachelorette then.
I was intrigued. Not only because she's 106, but because I wanted to know how someone stays inspired at that age. Because when we talk about getting older, we usually frame the conversation around loss. The things we lose as we age, our cognitive abilities, our mobility, our awareness, our loved ones. I've always thought getting older sounded so lonely. But sitting with Glenna in her living room, I saw firsthand a future that I wanted to be a part of. From CAP Radio, you're listening to This Is What It Feels Like to be 106 years old.
What's your motto, Grandma? Remember?
Yeah, simplify.
Where do you think you got that from? That motto or that way of life, you. So just no worries, no stress.
Don't worry about it. Why worry? Doesn't change anything. Right? Well, I don't know why I'm still alive, but pretty nice. I don't know why I'm still alive. I'm just lucky, I guess.
I met Glenna in her home in rural Rio Linda, California, where she's lived for over 40 years. Her maroon-colored recliner is in the center of the living room, next to a stack of books and an Alexa. There's a wall of family photographs in the hallway, lined up next to a couple of framed letters from Barack and Michelle Obama, congratulating her on her 100th birthday. Her granddaughters, Sarah and Cassie McFarland, are with us, helping facilitate the conversation. Because Glenna is hard of hearing these days.
Grandma, did you ever imagine you would be this old?
I never thought about it. What, do you think about it? Do you think about
I do, because of you.
I mean, do you think you're going to be that old?
I think I could be.
Well,
but I don't walk like you always did.
You probably get this like asked all the time, but do you have any secrets?
You mean the apple cider vinegar?
Is that your secret?
That's what I tell people because they're always asking me that. I said, well, I just drink a lot of apple cider vinegar.
The best day of Glenna's life was the day she was born.
February the 1st, 1916.
When I hear Glenna say the year she was born, 1916, I don't even know how to process that. And I'm even more baffled when she tells me that she's as old as her local public library.
That library was put there the day I was born. I'm not kidding.
When you think back at all of the historical events that have happened over the last century,
2, 1, 0, all engines running.
All of the inventions, the trends and fads of the decades,
Elvis Presley,
the Great Depression, both world wars,
December 7th, 1941, a date which will live
in infamy.
Not to mention, this is the second pandemic she's lived through. Glenna was born and raised in Columbus, Ohio, with her mother, father, and two sisters, Carrie and Ruby.
We'd be singing, you know, what do you call it? What were we doing?
Harmonizing?
Yeah, we did a lot of that.
Did you have a name?
No.
No.
Just the Hesse sisters.
Music has always been Glenna's first love and was a bonding force for her and her sisters. She tells me that she and her sisters played multiple instruments growing up and would perform in her town at local establishments. After she finished college, Glenna decided to follow her sister to Colorado. It was there she met her future husband, saxophone player Howard Duke Walters.
My sister Carrie had a very handsome guy, you know. And he was a good friend of the guy I married. They introduced us, and we rode in the rumble seat of the guy's car.
What's a rumble seat?
Well, it's just an open car, but it's got a seat in the back. And that's how I met him, my husband, Howard.
Shortly after, Glenna and Howard got married, but it was very short-lived.
Well, I was teaching school and he was going to school because I was older than he was by 3 years. So he went to college. That's when we first met and got married. And he said he didn't want me to live with him because he was in college, you know, and I was the old lady. So anyway, I just put my stuff in the trunk and went home and got a lawyer and said, forget about that.
Glenna got the marriage annulled and told Howard that he needed to mature if they were going to be together. This was the 30s, and here's Glenna setting clear boundaries with her husband. You just don't hear stories like that from this time period. We don't hear of women holding their own and leaving situations if they're unhappy. Eventually, Glenna and Howard would reunite 3 years later, but only after Howard matured and apologized to Glenna.
And he calls me up and says, no, we gotta get married. So he had friends and we got married again.
Glenna and Howard would end up having four children, Dan, Glenn, Susie, and Wendy. During this time, Howard played saxophone with the popular big band, the Sonny Denham Orchestra.
Howard was in the big band and played in New York. And I got on the train and went there. But we met Sinatra. He was on the program with Howard. You know, I've got Sinatra's
autograph?
Yeah.
As a touring musician myself, I was enamored hearing stories of those early jazz days in New York. But I couldn't help but wonder how they were able to support themselves in a project of that size. Playing in a large orchestra with all of those people meant dividing up the money. Glenna tells me that that's what led her and Howard to form their own family band.
Baronets. The Baronets.
Glenna played piano and sang. Howard played the saxophone, and their son Glenn played the drums. Soon the Baronets got their first gig in Michigan and hauled Glenna and her piano in a trailer along with their youngest child, Wendy, who was a toddler at the time, and drove across the country to play their first show as a trio.
Oh, that was a dandy.
Okay, so picture this. Glenna was touring the country in a van, hauling a trailer around with a full-size piano, all the while caring for a newborn baby. In the 50s. If you've ever been on tour, you know how difficult it is. The lack of sleep, the constant traveling, all of it is a grind. I cannot imagine experiencing all of that on top of taking care of a child and a family while also performing every night.
How was touring back then?
Touring?
Yeah, like how was traveling back then playing music? What was that like?
We had to carry that organ in a van.
You would bring that to every single venue? You would travel
every
with that?
Every time we had a different play, we had to do that.
Wow.
Well, that's how we started. Well, it was our first job, and we did that for several years in the summer.
The Baronets played for years until Howard developed emphysema and had to stop playing the saxophone. But Glenna kept touring with her son Glenn and daughter Wendy hitting the road, hauling that piano and trailer across the country.
I had to do the whole thing and drive all these places. You know, we had two kitty cats.
In the van with you?
Of course.
It's these moments where you get a clear glimpse into Glenna's spirit, her natural ability to go with the flow of life, to forge ahead, no matter what, and to have fun while doing it.
Do you have any important lessons that you've learned over the years?
Lessons? Mm-hmm. You mean what should you do and what you shouldn't do?
Yeah.
Well, you shouldn't do drugs. And I don't do drugs. And you don't smoke.
Glenna and Howard moved to Sacramento in 1975, watching their children create their own families. She says she spent a lot of that time making quilts, reading, and listening to music with Howard. But in 1991, Howard's health was severely declining. And after years of battling diabetes, Glenna forced Howard to go to the hospital.
Well, I gave him his last meal in the hospital. I fed it to him. Well, it's like this. When my husband died, it didn't even make me cry. He didn't want to go to the hospital. And I made him go. He had one leg cut off because he had diabetes. And he just wanted to die. He says, I want to croak, is what he said. And everybody said, oh, he wants a Coke. I said, no, he doesn't want a Coke because he drinks Pepsis. So, what he said, he wanted a Coke.
I'm struck by the ease in which Glenna is able to talk about loss. I'm sure she's had years to process this and to tell that story, but it's still remarkable to me that she's able to laugh at her own personal losses and see the lightness within it. And even though Glenna has this incredible way of letting go and living in the moment, she does reminisce about Howard and their relationship while I'm there.
Well, I fell in love with that saxophone. Yes. I was very much in love with him. Well, what you looking at?
After Howard died, Glenna says she found a new sense of self by taking many solo cross-country trips to state and national parks.
All by myself. And spent money on myself. I did. And I still have the shirt that I bought. I do. It cost me $17.
Coming up, I ask Glenna what she thinks the meaning of life is. and it's not going to be what you think.
I want to know, what do you think the meaning of life is?
I had asked this question hoping that Glenna was going to reveal some big secret, the big answer to the mystery that we're all trying to figure out.
The meaning?
Yeah.
Well, you're born, you have no, it just happens.
You have no choice in the matter.
I have no choice.
I have to admit, initially, I was a bit let down by her answer, because I wanted an easy answer, something tangible that I could hold on to and take with me, share with folks, that instant gratification. And at the time, sitting with her in her living room, I didn't quite get that. But it was during listening back to this interview, I realized that Glenna gets it.
What brings you joy?
What brings me joy? Music. Mm. I like music. It's the best of everything.
Glenna tells me that she likes a lot of different genres of music, but jazz has always been her number one. She turns to the Alexa that is sitting on her side table.
Alexa, Andre Previn needs to play some jazz.
What's your routine? What do you do every morning? What's your steps throughout the day?
Good heavens, girl. You sure you want to know?
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, I come out here. I have to eat a banana because I love a banana. And you have to eat something before you take your pills. I've got my pills. So I eat a banana, drink orange juice, and a bowl of cereal. Then I come out here, eat a dish of peanuts and my cookies and watch my soaps.
Glenna still plays the piano and reads a lot. She tells me that she's kept track of every single book she's read since she was 65.
Grandma, how many books do you have in your journal?
4,100. 4,000 something.
Since when?
Since I turned 65. I was keeping track of the books I read.
You've read that many since then?
Yeah.
That's incredible.
I've got them in the book.
How long does each book take to read?
About a week.
Why don't you tell them what book you got from the library, the big one?
Well, it's right over there. It says Barack Obama, and it's that thick. No kidding, no kidding. I'm going to read it. I think.
Is that your next book that you're going to read?
No, I think I'll leave that till last.
I'm struck by her ability to plan ahead at this age, but even more so to have the optimism to plan ahead. I have a hard time planning out my week, let alone a full list of books I want to read for the winter.
What are your thoughts on all of the technology and cell phones we all have?
Well, I usually think we sure waste a lot of time. Wasting a lot of time.
As we're wrapping up the conversation, Glenna's granddaughter Cassie asks her if she believes in an afterlife.
You might as well say zero.
Zero? What's that mean? What do you think?
Because you've lived your life, that's all you get.
My biggest takeaway from sitting and talking with Glenna was the simplicity in everything around her and the immense joy she got from that. Her daily routine of eating peanuts and drinking iced tea while watching soap operas or hanging out with her family, playing the piano. Today, it's our productivity and our output that is praised. It's go, go, go all the time, nonstop mentality. Sometimes I forget the why in my day-to-day grind. but Glenna seems to always have her why and focus. Her secret to living this long, fulfilling life is simply just that. Live. Don't overcomplicate it. Because we don't have much of a choice in any of this anyway. All we can really do is show up and try to have fun in the process. I'm honored that I got to spend time with Glenna and her granddaughters, Cassie and Sarah. It's not every day that you get to hang out with someone who's lived well over a century, and who has lived through so many historical moments and has seen firsthand the country evolve and progress. But even more than that, I needed it. I needed to see that life can be joyous at that age, that you can still feel inspired and determined and laugh a lot, and that we can reinvent ourselves at any age, at any point in our lives, if we stay curious about life and not take everything and ourselves so seriously. I used to be afraid of getting older, but after hanging out with Glenna, I'm actually kind of excited and curious about what life could be like at 100, if I'm lucky.
What was the best day of my life? The day I was born, honey.
That was Glenna Lucille Walters of Rio Linda, California. We recorded this interview in the summer of 2022, 2 days before her 106th birthday. 2 months after this initial interview, Glenna's youngest sister Ruby passed away at the age of 103. Glenna turned 107 on February 1st, 2023. She spent her birthday celebrating with her family, in her home, doing all of the things that she loved. Exactly 1 month later, on March 1st, 2023, Glenna passed away at the age of 107. She was surrounded by her loved ones. The gift of Glenna will stay with me, and I hope it will do the same for you. Thank you, Glenna, for sharing yourself with us.
That is an episode from Cap Radio's newest podcast, This Is What It Feels Like, which puts listeners in the shoes of everyday people at the center of issues often overlooked or politicized by society. Host Tara Lopez featured a woman named Glenna, thriving at 106 years old, who gave her take on the secrets to living a long life, as well as finding joy and purpose. Glenna passed away earlier this year, shortly after her 107th birthday, at home, surrounded by generations of family. Glenna's granddaughter, Cassie Zook, joined us on Insight after her passing about how her grandmother shapes how she lives her life.
In her transition of death, which, you know, I'm still sitting in my grief, and it still kind of stings to hear her voice, but I know that I can look within myself, and I have those teachings, and I have that kind of roadmap to carry on with me. So, you know, just being with her, I really hope to kind of, you know, raise my children like she raised me, and not be afraid of getting dirt under your nails, and, you know, not worrying about simple things, because she was so good at living in the present. She knew how valuable that was, and she knew that that was honestly like our only possession, truly. So she lived with very little. She wanted not much, but she lived so abundantly because of that. And she created a space for her family. And I think because she and I had this relationship where we were just so sure of each other, and she made me feel authentic, and she was so wholly authentic, it gave me the confidence to kind of just be myself.
You can listen to the first season of Cap Radio's This Is What It Feels Like wherever you get your podcasts. You're listening to a special edition of Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
Welcome back to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. As we say goodbye to 2023, we want to thank you for being part of the more than 500 conversations we've had this year. We take a lot of pride in the environment that we create here on this show, and we are so grateful for the guests that take the time to break down complicated issues, open up to widen our perspectives, and be vulnerable, even though it can be uncomfortable. Insight wouldn't be what it is without you listening. And we look forward to a new year of shows that hopefully will give you a better understanding of the world and make you feel more connected to home. That is it for Insight for 2023. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also connect with us by sending us an email at insight@capradio.org. Thank you to producer Sarit Lashinsky and managing editor Aram Sarkissian. Our digital producer and audio engineer is Chris Feltz. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones. Our show music is produced by Adrian Gilmore. And I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. Have a great new year. We'll catch you in 2024.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.